Zero CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
Sometimes I just cannot believe...
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. Police say an 18-year-old man killed three people and wounded several others, including officers, when he fired on a Farmington, New Mexico street today. Police say they shot and killed the shooter.
Officers responded to the area to find a chaotic scene where a male subject was actively firing upon individuals in that neighborhood.
Farmington Police Deputy Chief Barrick Crum. They've arrested a man who attacked a Virginia congressman's staff with a baseball bat in Fairfax, Virginia. The target was apparently Democratic Congressman Jerry Connolly. Police Sergeant Lisa Gardner.
We found two victims. They sustained non-life-threatening injuries, and they were both transported to local hospitals.
Congressman was not in his district office during the attack. Another debt ceiling meeting tomorrow between the president and congressional leaders. House Speaker McCarthy asked if he thought they could reach a deal soon.
Not based upon what they're offering right now.
This is ABC News. The World Health Organization on non-sugar sweeteners.
The WHO finds non-sugar sweeteners don't provide any long-term benefit when it comes to reducing body fat, and that over time they could lead to harmful conditions like type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular diseases, and even death. The organization now recommends anyone except people with pre-existing diabetes avoid the sweeteners, which are used in some food and beverage products and also sold on their own. That doesn't apply to non-food products that use them. Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
Attorney General Merrick Garland kicking off National Police Week with an address in front of the U.S. Capitol.
Today, we honor 443 extraordinary officers who made the ultimate sacrifice for their communities. That we do so here, in front of our Capitol, and surrounded by the institutions that make up our democracy, is no accident.
Andy Field, ABC News.
Great to listen to while having a Liney's and grilling some Sheboygan brats. The Cripes Cast with me, Charlie Behrens, on Civic Media, and don't forget the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matinere. Here's what you need to know. A teacher at a Grafton middle school was arrested on Friday for making threats against students after a student found a piece of paper with swastikas on it. The teacher at John Long Middle School is Jewish and admitted to making threatening statements to students because he was angry. The teacher, who among other things told students he owns 17 guns, has not been identified. Gas prices are higher than last week, but still lower than 1 month ago. Average prices in Wisconsin are 20 cents lower than last month, nearly 90 cents a gallon lower than this time last year. Industry analysts say barring a disaster, prices should stay below $4 a gallon in the coming weeks. And Poinette native Ashley Hagenow earned the title of Alice in Dairyland over the weekend. I'm Jane Matinere. This is Civic Media News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
Hello? I'm a Marine.
No matter how you served.
My buddies from the Army are all gone now. I'm really alone.
No matter what you're going through.
I keep getting calls about the bills, and I'm trying to get a job. I feel so stuck.
We are here for you. If you or a veteran in your life is experiencing thoughts of suicide, dial 988, then press 1 to reach the Veterans Crisis Line.
US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Don't let biased algorithms or degree screens or exclusive professional networks, or stereotypes. Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight.
The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
Think who to hate and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Infrastructure Week. Yes, it is Infrastructure Week. I remember there was a four-year span where we had Infrastructure Week like every week. There were tons of displays, tons of stuff going on, lots of photo ops. Trump with the little hat and the shovel, driving a truck, playing with levers. Lots of PR stunts. Lots of stuff going on to make you think, hey, they're doing something. They're rebuilding America. And yet, not a thing got done. Lots of rhetoric, lots of talk, lots of tweeting, not much action. And I look at the fact that it's been 18 months since the president signed the infrastructure bill into law. And over those 18 months, they've announced somewhere around $200 billion in funding for what they're saying are 32,000 projects across the country in all states, not politically motivated, not, no, you didn't vote for us, nothing for you. No, actually looking at getting stuff done. And now here's the thing, what I love about what the administration is doing, 83% of us, 83% of registered voters, both sides of the aisle, no aisle, think we should be making the stuff here. You know, like here, like made in America. You know, if you're going to use steel in the bridge that we're going to drive over, maybe here, you know, just a thought, because you want that reverberation effect. You want those jobs that will come out of this spending to be, you know, here, because we've got some job issues, especially the kind that pay a decent living wage, like a lot of my building trades, construction folks, the wages that they earn. Again, you know, I said this January of 2017. Had Trump come out and said, we're going to have massive investment in infrastructure. Because you remember, he was talking about $2 trillion at the time. He's talking a huge, massive amount of money. I said, back then, I said, if he does this, if he goes and he does infrastructure in a big way, I'm a big supporter, big fan, think we should be doing it. He would have gotten reelected he would have gotten elected without question, in my view. But they didn't. They chose the political, they chose the show, they chose the flash without actually doing the work. And this is where I give Biden credit. They talked about it. They got something passed, and they're doing it. Not a lot of fanfare. In fact, I haven't seen my idea anywhere, which is giant 20-foot Joe Biden signs with, you know, hey, I did this. I haven't seen that. I'm hoping they come around to it, because I think we need to do some of that stuff. But this administration is just about getting the stuff done. And what they're doing it with, you know, in creating jobs that can't easily be outsourced and are probably going to be around for a while. I don't know that robotics and AI are going to be able to take those just yet. And sadly, we're heading towards an era, and this is where I'm really concerned, because, you know, I've had some of these conversations recently about, you know, about jobs in the future. And what's interesting to me is while Democrats and Republicans have finally gotten their heads out of you know where on bad trade deals, again, I give Trump credit. He had his thumb on the pulse. Our trade deals, you know, something I've been screaming about for decades. He didn't actually do anything about it. Look, I'm okay. I liked what they got accomplished in the USMCA. I think that was good. It was a step in the right direction. I like the fact that there were some tariffs on China, not much else. But finally, everyone's kind of coming around. I think the pandemic had a little bit to do with it as well. Too, you need local manufacturing. You need local supply chains. Now, my problem with this is it's coming at a time when robotics and AI seem to be coming more and more online. So the money that we're going to spend reshoring manufacturing could come at a, well, really no job increase kind of format. And this is where, you know, my mind goes into this weird spot, because I had a conversation with a couple of my union buddies. And it's a conversation that, you know, I have this a lot, but this time somehow it stuck with me. Because one of the guys, you know, said, you know, in 5 years, I don't care what happens, because he thinks he's going to be okay. He thinks his pension is going to be there because he's got a good union pension. He saved a good bit of money. He's going to have Social Security. You know, all of the three-legged stool is strong for him, he thinks. And, you know, I said, look, you know, the sad reality is you've done all the right things and you're probably going to be okay. But there's crisis coming. There's a tsunami of job loss on its way that no one is prepared for. I mean, policy-wise, we've done nothing. You know, when the bad trade deals were being done, and they knew they were going to be bad for the working class. They knew there were going to be, you know, millions of jobs lost. They knew it was going to be bad, which is why they put trade adjustment assistance in. Why they had a policy to say, okay, if you're one of the losers in this policy, we're gonna throw you a little bone. We're gonna give you a little help, a couple years of unemployment benefits, some education money so you can go get retrained to do some other, you know, much worse paying job. But it was there, at least, you know, or something. Understand, we don't have trade adjustment assistance anymore on the books. Republicans block that. It is done. There's nothing. You lose your job because of a bad trade deal. Sorry, out of luck, brother. And I've been saying there's got to be something modeled like that, like a technology adjustment assistance. I've been calling for a technology tax for years now. It's something that is getting no attention, because we're too busy fighting. We're too busy in the pie fight. We're too busy about who's going to what bathroom or who's wearing a dress, or, you know, we're too busy over, you know, a book in a library that nobody knew was there until someone got crazy. Look at this outrage. You know, we're fed daily doses of outrage candy to keep us, you know, not thinking about what's really going on. What's going on is we got problems in the future. So as I was having this conversation, I was saying, look, much like the person I stood and talked to on election night in 2016, who was a very conservative pollster and political operative, said it's going to be interesting watching liberals become states' rights people. We're in this moment of watching, you know, conservatives, I think at some point coming, especially working class conservatives, coming around to the idea that there's got to be some kind of social safety net again, that there's got to be some way, if all the jobs are going to be done with artificial intelligence or robotics or automation or in these ways, there's got to be some way that people are going to be able to eat, and a way of people, when they lose their jobs, you know, finding the next gig. There's none of that yet. And as I was explaining this to my friend who said in 5 years doesn't care about anything, you know, I said, well, what about your kids? You know, what are they going to inherit? You know, what kind of an economy, what kind of job future? I go, you know, when our parents, you know, sent us out in the world, they kind of had a sense of what life could be like for us. When their parents sent them out into the world, it was kind of the same thing. Had a sense. You work hard, you play by the rules, you get ahead. We're now in this weird kind of space where I don't think anybody really has a grasp of what 20 years is going to get. And if the way I'm looking at things, if these reports that I'm reading are accurate and that half of the jobs we currently do will be gone in 15 years now, what are all these people going to do? And what are industries going to do, like my union buddy who is in the trucking industry, when all of the trucks are going to be, you know, automated, so no need for drivers, and the dock work can be done by robots. There's no one paying into pension plans, so you're one of your legs of the stool gone bye-bye, because the pension's set up on we need young workers to take those jobs and have their career and pay into a pension fund. That's how it works. Same thing with Social Security. You know, in a couple of years, like 7-8 years, if we continue to do nothing, which is what Congress is really good at, they're talking about a 20 to 23% cut in Social Security across the board. So nobody's focusing on that because we can't fix it. Again, we're stuck on who's going to what bathroom or who's wearing a dress or who's doing all this other stuff without talking about what's the future going to look like. Now, my buddies, good friends of mine, you know, ranged from calling me a socialist, then a fascist, and then a communist, ultimately, in the span of about 20 minutes. Simply because I believe that we need smart policy to distribute the wealth of this country more equitably. And you know me, I'm a union guy, so first it's through work, through the wages that we earn, through strong unions, fighting for better wages, hours, conditions, distributing wealth, you know, kind of the way it was with our grandparents' generation when they were in the heart of their work lives. And then, honestly, by any means necessary, you know, I'm not terribly on the side of universal basic income, but I'm not against it. I'm not against the idea of redistributive policies, you know, whatever they may be at some point. But we're not talking about any of this on the policy level. Now, what's interesting to me is I was watching a clip of Warren Buffett. And Warren Buffett was asked, you know, who's winning in this economy? And now I could easily answer that. He is. And that's what he said. He goes, the rich, people like me. He said, we've gone from, and I've cited this before, and this is Warren Buffett saying it. We've gone from $93 billion in wealth to the top 400 on the Forbes 400 in 1982 to $2.4 trillion today. He said, look, as the economy becomes more specialized, he points out that we used to be an agrarian economy. You know, a couple hundred years ago, he said it was very hard to get 20 times the wealth of the next guy because you were a little bit better of a farmer. He says, but, you know, if you're better at some skills, people can become incredibly wealthy today at a young age. And it's not because you earned the money. It's not because you built a steel mill and then earned money to build another one and you built something. He says, today you can capitalize an idea that makes people incredible amounts of money. Now, that's good for a handful of people, with good ideas, and we need those. We need entrepreneurs, and we need people who have ideas. For them, it's going to be great. But for the working class, for the people who get up every day and punch a clock or their idea doesn't catch on, what is that going to mean? What is that going to mean for average, everyday working people? And what it means is a Dickinsonian kind of world of a handful of ultra extraordinarily wealthy people and then a bunch of people in poverty. Now, I came across this graph, this infographic that was just fantastic. It's done with World Inequality Database information that points out that, you know, countries treat their wealthy and their poor, you know, very differently. And, you know, they point out that it, being poor in a place like Slovakia, is almost like being poor here in the U.S., except the country, more than twice as wealthy. And they point out that, you know, while the median income of the median income is about 74,000-75,000, the income for the poorest 20% is down near the Saudi Arabia area, under 15 grand, like 13 something. And they point out, this graph points out that in Norway, you know, income wise, we're about the same. In Norway, the wealth of the folks there at the bottom 20%, more than double, over 35 grand, you know, like 37 grand. And you go, how's that? How's that possible? Policy. It comes back down to policy. As I say all the time, I believe in sound spending, smart policy. We use our tax dollars judiciously to do the things that we need, and we use policy to make people's lives better. So I'm curious, your thoughts. Are we heading in the right direction? Are you concerned about the future? Are you concerned about the AI tsunami, or, you know, what are they calling this? The fourth technological revolution. I'm curious. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Or is this much ado about nothing? And because, hey, you know, we've lived through tough times before. We've lived through transitions, and we've come out better and richer on the other side. Except if you're in the bottom, I don't know, 90% of the economy. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. You miss any portion of the program, get the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcasts, you will find ours. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Bill writes me, the AI revolution is overblown. It's not going to be as bad as you're making it out to be. There are millions of jobs that can never be done. The building trades are the area that will be least affected. I got to tell you, Bill, I don't know. I was at the convention, the AFL-CIO's convention last year, and each of the trades had their display. I went and I saw the bricklayers had this robotic hand that would pick up bricks, pick up, you know, double the size bricks and just move them wherever you wanted them. So no longer do you have to be a big hulking guy to be able to move these bricks around. You got a machine that'll help. It's called the Mule. You look at the smart unions, the sheet metal workers. They've got all of these cool toys. I mean, really, you know, at this moment, helpful technology that in years past you needed to do You needed to do a lot to be able to do the job. Now, I put on the virtual reality goggles, and all you saw were all the ductwork in a building wherever the plans were. It was quite remarkable. They got a dog that runs around and measures stuff. They got all kinds of stuff. And they said that what is coming is unimaginable and will eventually replace people. So I'm a little concerned about it. Let's go to the phones. Got Frank in Illinois on line one. Frank, how are we doing today?
Doing well, Rick. Thanks for taking my call. Fascinating subject, I think, about the entrepreneurs. When I was in college, I think they called them idea champions. I used to work for the Bell & Howell Company. They used to be a Fortune 500 company. Then they went private. I'm sure you've heard that before. But anyway, back to the ideas. I am working on an invention at this time. I just wanted to know your thoughts on any kind of government help for idea champions. In other words, in the form of either a tax break or a tax credit. Let's say, you know, there have to be guidelines and rules. For example, if they went to their patent attorney, and they would have to show receipts to the government that, oh, yes, I'm here are the bills for my patent attorney. Just wondering your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I don't off the top of my head, I don't know of any, but I will ask a couple of people that I think might know, or at least they should know. But it's an interesting thought, because, you know, at the end of the day, my concern is the employment that we're used to, that my generation grew up believing was going to be around, I fear is not, and we're going to all have to potentially be our own, you know, our own business commodity at some point. So I'm interested to see what comes out of that as well. Appreciate the call, Frank.
Right. Thanks, Rick. Bye.
No, I mean, you know, I don't, like I said, I don't know what the future is going to bring us. I look at the technology and I'm like, there's scary stuff. For instance, they've been talking about, you know, the deepfakes are going to be really, you know, the technology has gotten so incredibly, you know, advanced that the so-called deepfakes, you know, that's down the road. Oh no. I don't know if you've been paying attention. There's been a lot of stuff that's been popping up that has just been there. That you go, how is that? How is that? How did they do that? It's amazing to me. But it's not a year. It's not years away. It's now. And that's the thing. Like, I try and tell my kids, you know, what are they going to do in the coming months? In years, what's their future going to look? I don't know. I'm trying to advise them in the best way I can, to help the best I can. But it is what it is. It's one of those things that policymakers have done a really crummy job. Honestly, I mean, they've done a really crummy job at preparing us for what's coming. And that's the frightening part in all of this. And why I think at some point we better figure it out. Let's quick go to the phones. Got Pete on line two. Pete, how we doing?
All right, sir. It's totally off topic. I was just wondering if you saw last night, I saw a commercial on TV last night for Bud Light, and they had the Zac Brown Band playing in the background. And I know all the controversy that's been around Bud Light and the stupidity that surrounds it. And I was just wondering if you could find somebody to figure out if that's a new commercial or if he was under contract prior to that. Because I thought if he stepped out and he, you know, really received well with the, you know, the country crowd, I was just wondering how that's playing with them. Whether it was a backlash on his part saying you're stupid, you know, there's other things to worry about, or whether that was contracted prior to all this going down.
I'll have to look into it. I haven't seen the ad, but I will look for it.
All right, thanks, sir.
Appreciate it, Peter. But, you know, here's the thing. I mean, I said from the beginning, what a stupid controversy. And you know, one, why would Bud Light throw themselves into it? I don't get why corporate America feels they need to try and pick sides. Do your business. But in this vein, such a stupid controversy. Who cares? And here's the thing. I didn't drink Bud Light, and I guess this is what they were thinking. I did not drink Bud Light ever. I don't think a Bud Light has ever touched my lips. until Sunday when my wife and I went out to dinner. And that was me going, I'm going to have a beer. I'm going to have a Bud Light just because of this. Just because how stupid this is. And it wasn't great. I won't have another one, but it is what it is. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. To take a quick break when we come back. Jessica Goodhart's going to be here from Capital in Maine. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1919. That was the day the Winnipeg Trades and Labor Council called a general strike. It is considered one of the most important strikes in Canadian history. Social tensions intensified as soldiers returned home in search of work, only to find skyrocketing unemployment and inflation. In Winnipeg, building trades and metal workers attempted to organize and bargain as an umbrella organization. They walked off the job at the beginning of May, appealing to the city's unions for support. And on this day in 1919, some 30,000 workers walked off the job, starting with women telephone operators. The general strike had begun. Union and non-union workers alike heeded the call. Factories shut down. Public services came to a halt, including transit, mail services, and utilities. Having lost most of their workers to the strike, newspapers quickly branded strikers as Bolsheviks, depicting them as bomb throwers in cartoons. Winnipeg's bosses formed the Citizens Committee of 1000 and declared the general strike a conspiracy led by alien scum. When the police sided with the strikers, they were fired and replaced in their entirety by specials used to break the strike. Workers were intransigent, and by the middle of June, the federal government ordered the arrest of strike leaders. When tens of thousands of workers gathered on June 21st for a demonstration at Market Square, they were charged by the Royal Mounted Police, armed with clubs and guns. Two strikers were killed, and scores more were injured in what is known as Bloody Saturday. Winnipeg was under military occupation, and the strike ended in heavy losses for the workers. But many strike leaders won regional political elections the following year, defeating the very forces that smashed their strike. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
There's a common political refrain among Texas progressives. Thank God for Mississippi. Our own state government, run by corporate lobbyists and right-wing nutballs, is a notorious hellhole for efforts to provide even a little more fairness for the poor, the working class, and the environment. So, Lone Star progressives need some straw to grasp to keep from tumbling into the ditch of total despair. Mississippi has been that straw. No matter how mingy our state officials are, Texans can count on the Magnolia State to be one digit worse. But have mercy! Texans are suddenly in danger of losing our reputational buffer, for Mississippi is close to making a momentous upgrade this election year. An unabashed working-class Democrat with a program of For the People reforms and an anti-plutocrat campaign for governor has already pulled even with a right-wing incumbent. Brandon Presley is the upstart's name, a little-d Democratic populist elected at 23 years old to be mayor of his small hometown where he still lives. He's now in his fourth term as a highly effective, widely popular member of the State Utility Commission. There, he has successfully battled the electric power giants and telecom profiteers on behalf of everyday ratepayers, workers, and the environment. Presley, who actually is an Elvis cousin, is not a pure liberal. He's pro-gun and anti-choice. But this is Mississippi, and while it's essential to strive for the pure light of liberalism, a multiracial majority of workaday Mississippians see Presley as a pure champion of basics they've long been denied, from health care to voting rights. So they're rallying for change. After all, even a dog knows the difference between being stumbled over and being kicked. This is Jim Hightower saying, the people of Mississippi know they're being kicked by the moneyed powers. And Brandon Presley is saying, let's kick back. To learn more, go to brandonpresley.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Politico reported today that that Democrats are going to be putting the full court press on to get Julie Sue not confirmed as Secretary of Labor. And I'm like, you know, how is this so difficult? Democrats, get your head out of the sand. Get Biden's people, his appointees, get them confirmed so they can get to work making working people's lives better. But again, you know, this is another one of those moments. You've got conservative Democrats who, well, Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, who are going to be the fly in the ointment here to share some thoughts on how difficult this may be to get Julie Sue confirmed and what it would mean if we did. I've asked Jessica Goodhart to come talk with us. She's a senior reporter over at Capital and Maine, capitalandmaine.com, the website. Jessica, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
So what is the hang up here? This woman is qualified. This is somebody we should want. Every working person should want someone like her as the head of the Department of Labor, someone who knows the job, someone who's been doing it. This seems like just a natural fit. Why is it not happening?
Well, it's interesting, too, because she has actually already been confirmed by the Senate to be deputy secretary to Marty Walsh. She's already served with him in that post, and she's actually now acting secretary of labor. She's been secretary of labor in California. She's been the top labor enforcer in California. Julie Sue has been kind of at this work since the 1990s, really, when she first came. She first came to my attention when she was just out of law school and she was representing Thai seamstresses who were enslaved, actually, at a sweatshop in El Monte, California. And she sued. She did something really interesting and important. She held the retailers and manufacturers liable for violations and won a big settlement. $4 million was a lot of money at the time for those garment workers, or about 72 garment workers. So, I mean, to your question, what's the holdup? I mean, I think it's a list, as you mentioned, a list of senators. Joe Manchin, who's in a close, in a tough, I guess, race in West Virginia. Kyrsten Sinema. You know, there's a list that all of those senators have been targeted by active campaigns, by business lobbies.
Business lobby. So now I think I'm getting the fuller picture. I've already had it, but you know, it's the moneyed interests. The well-heeled, the moneyed interest, corporate America doesn't want someone who's going to be a champion of working people. So they're putting the monetary pressure on these senators. And because our system is set up on, you know, hey, you got to bring in money. This is it. And this is what frustrates me, Jessica, because things that working people need never get addressed. It's always the interests of the wealthy and the powerful that get their issues and their concerns addressed. But working people like you and me, we're stiffed.
So, you know, when I saw that Julie Sue was running into this campaign, I reached out to David Weil. David Weil is probably not a household name. People probably haven't heard of him, but he was head of wage and hour division within the Labor Department under President Obama, and he was a nominee for the wage and hour division. He was Biden's nominee, and he came up against the same kind of fierce attack last year and was defeated. And so the groups that are now kind of spearheading this attack on Julie Sue are the same ones that went after David Weil. And so I gave him a call, and that's sort of what the article that was published in Capital Maine was, is my conversation with him. And I was like, hey, what's going on? And, you know, he said, you know, in some ways he said, you know, well, you know, what's going on is that Julie Sue was effective, you know, and in some ways this attack on her is to be expected. And in some ways, I think it's a reflection of how closely divided the Senate is, And then I think add to that, you have, you know, she's comes from California, where the California, she was labor commissioner.
Right. And wildly popular, as I understand, because of some of the stuff she did around gig work and other stuff.
Well, it's a little more complicated than that. She oversaw the implementation of a state law that granted employment status to gig workers, which was opposed by Uber and Lyft. And it's a bit of a long and winding story, but they put a measure on the ballot that passed in 2019. They put a measure on the ballot, Proposition 22, which was a $200 million effort on their part that passed. The voters, you know, approved that measure. And so, and that often happens in the state now, that the referendum process, which was meant as a way for, you know, a sort of a populist check on corporate power, has kind of been flipped in the state and has been sort of...
Because they can spend the money. You said $220
million? $200 million.
My grandfather used to tell me, if a rich guy is going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it, because they understand return on investment. So that $200 million that they spent, they know they're going to make back double, triple, quadruple. They know it's an investment well worth making. And what does that mean? It means working people are going to make less money. There's going to be less in the money of pockets of families to put food on the table and a roof over their head. So, yeah, welcome to America. Back again.
Yeah. And, you know, it should be said that, Julie, that was a law passed by the legislature. And right. As labor secretary, she was just, you know, charged with enforcing it. And that would be her same role as labor secretary, would be to enforce the laws on the books.
I've heard, Jessica, maybe you can help me here, because I've heard that part of the problem that they have is they're afraid that she's going to actually use the tools that the Department of Labor has to advocate for working people, much in the same way that Jennifer Abruzzo over at the NLRB has been doing, saying, look, you know, we're going to be aggressive in our use of what's available to us. We're going to be aggressive in using this department to advance working people. And that, again, the people who spent $200 million to fight back against making gig employees actual workers, they don't want that either.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, what David, you know, Weil said is that, you know, she's currently acting labor secretary. And so, you know, I kind of was curious to know, well, what's the difference between an acting and actually having a labor secretary?
Yeah, she's got a year.
Confirmed. And he's, you know, he says it's really important to have a confirmed labor secretary, and that there's a lot of work to be done, and that having that post empty is a real problem right now. And that, you know, enforcing labor laws has become more difficult as the structure of work has shifted over the years.
And look, it's getting worse, because I don't know if you've been noticing. there are states who have lost their ever-loving freaking minds. I'm looking at Iowa and the child labor bill that they just pushed through. I'm going, I don't know how you put 13, 14-year-olds back on the kill floor of a meat pump. I don't know how you do that. And where you need someone who's going to be at the federal level going, no, we're not doing that. We're not going back 100 years. And I think, again, I think that's what they're afraid of, is that she will step in and not allow that to happen.
Right. And you have like all these layers right now. Between, you know, what the sort of lead companies and who are the companies that are actually hiring workers. So, you know, in 2014, Weil wrote this book called The Fissured Workplace that talked about that shift towards subcontracting and how it's eroded job quality. And so every time you create a new layer, like a staffing agency or subcontracting, each of those companies has to make some kind of profit margin. And that means that there's less and less for workers, and it can incentivize labor violations of minimum wage or overtime rules. sometimes. And it can also make it, you know, to your point about the NLRB, can make it harder to organize.
Absolutely. And that's the reason you see these third party corporations, you know, coming in, because if you organize them, you just get rid of them and bring somebody else in. So it really puts up a huge barrier for workers to be able to demand better wages, hours, conditions. And again, we know this, which is why that they want to keep pushing the status quo, I believe.
Right. And so I think what a labor department that's really committed to weeding out violations can be really looking at, you know, not just where the violation is occurring, but where, you know, the responsibility lies. And, you know, my interview with Dave Weil, he was, you know, he really attributed the explosion in child labor to this trend. You know, so you have the children as young as 13 and 17 working at slaughterhouses and meatpacking plants now, has come to light in the reporting. And so that's the kind of thing that the Department of Labor really needs to get to work on. And that is, you know, that is sort of some of its urgent business.
Yeah.
And actually, I mean, I will say that when I listened to the committee hearing for Julie Sue, child labor was something that was raised by Republicans and Democrats. That meaning, you can say, I'm not sure, you know, but the Republicans, I should say, all voted against her. But they at least gave lip service to being concerned.
Because again, you look at these states that are pushing these repeals and these changes in child labor laws. They're all Republicans. And I wish there were some sane among them. There just don't appear to be any at this moment. And I thought child labor was one of those things where we go, no, that's a nonpartisan issue. We don't want, you know, 13-year-olds doing dangerous jobs. I thought that was decided. I thought that was, hey, we're in the 21st century. We don't want 19th century practices for our kids. I really thought that, but here we are. Here we are.
Yeah, here we are. I know, here we are. And so I think it's easy to have deniability when, you know, you're it's a company, it's a subcontractor or a sub that's, you know, doing that hiring. And so it makes the work of the Labor Department trickier. And it makes the leadership piece more important.
You talked about the company, the organizations that were out against her. You know, do you have an idea of who they are? I guess like we could probably the NFIB, the other NRA. I'm sure there are a bunch of these quote unquote small business kind of associations that are massive, that have huge lobbying arms and that kind of stuff, who work against workers and their needs. I'm sure there was a whole alphabet soup of them. No.
Yeah. I mean, I think two of the leading organizations that are worth mentioning are the Flex Association, which represents the gig the companies like Uber, Lyft, and then the International Franchise Association. The International Franchise Association includes companies like McDonald's, you know, Burger King, and other, you know, major franchises, and you know they. You know, Weil told me that, you know, they portray themselves as sort of the face of small business, but that he says that they really represent the large franchisors. And, you know, that's a whole other story because, you know, franchising is a really common business form. And, you know, we see franchises everywhere, right? And in fact, you know, Julie Sue's parents, she pointed out in her testimony, had a pizza franchise and a dry cleaning franchise. The franchisees themselves are often squeezed between the franchisor. They are often small businesses who are often squeezed themselves.
So this is one of those weird things because, you know, I have friends out on the West Coast, you know, my Teamster friends out on the West Coast organized a delivery, an Amazon delivery unit. and they're a franchise. They don't actually work for Amazon. They work for a company that is leased through Amazon, and they were saying the same thing, that these franchises are getting squeezed. They're having to break laws and do all kinds of things to make drivers work longer and harder and faster and all this, and the money's not flowing because Amazon is squeezing them. So shouldn't this be a moment where all of the franchisees of the world, all of these people who own the local McDonald's or the local Dairy Queen or the local whatever, rise up and go, no, the behemoth's been screwing us too. Shouldn't this be a pitchfork moment of unity, don't you think?
I think it's complicated.
So you're going with no. Okay, I went too far.
I think that there has been organizing among franchisees. And there's been some really interesting reporting on that, but it's complicated because
it doesn't seem that complicated to me. I want to see her. I want to see Julie Sue as the labor secretary. Any last question I've got for you? What are the chances of her getting confirmed? Or do you see this as another acting scenario for a bit until they come up with somebody else?
Yeah, I don't have a crystal ball. I'm sorry, Rick.
No, I figured that someone would have said, hey, it's probably going to happen. It's not going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen, but we will see. Jessica, I appreciate the time. Great work you guys do over at Capital in Maine. I hope folks will check out the website, capitalinmaine.com. We'll get links out on social media. How you can check out the work that they do. Jessica Goodhart, I appreciate the time.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Outstanding stuff. Again, capitalinmaine.com. The website. Can take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1917. That was the day of the founding of the Library Employees Union of Greater New York. This was the first public library workers union in the United States. From its beginning, one of the key efforts of the union was the fight for equal rights for women and men in the library field. Maud Malone was one of the leading spokeswomen for the union. She was also an active supporter of the campaign for women to win the right to vote. The union leaders worked to build relationships with other women's rights organizations. According to a report on the first 2 years of the union's activities, the union arose out of the need to remedy the particularly bad working conditions and wages of librarians, especially in the public libraries of the city. The union wanted to improve the promotion system, especially for women. In order to strengthen their cause, the union leaders corresponded with libraries as far away as England, France, Australia, Africa, and South America. These exchanges centered on discussing the library question from the union point of view. Promoting the union point of view to library workers proved to be a tough task. The union tried to convince library employees to think of themselves as workers and part of the working class. The union advocated for library employees to be included as part of the city's civil service system. But many of these workers thought of themselves as professionals. And in the end, this hesitancy to buy into the idea of unionization led to the downfall of the Library Employees Union, which ended its efforts in 1929. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So evidently, it's been a couple of days since Title 42 has gone the wayside. And look, this was supposed to be, the big Fox News right wing, hate fest. This was supposed to be Joe Biden did all this. And what's interesting is this is weird, even to me, that evidently fewer people showed up to the border than was expected. But according to the reports, over the past 2 days, U.S. border authorities saw a 50% drop in the number of migrant encounters along the U.S. southern border compared to just a week before. It's weird. I don't get it. Now, the problem hasn't gone away. We still don't have an immigration policy that we're doing anything about. Congress, do your job. Here's the thought. It was all teed up. This was going to be the Fox News. This was going to be glaring headlines. And now it was such a nothing that they had to find something else. So here comes the Durham Report. Yes, the Durham Report. And here's the weird thing. Depending on where you get your news, this is either, oh my God, it's a smoking gun, we got him, or it's a giant nothing burger. I got an email from someone who said, I'd like to hear what you think. Probably you won't comment. You won't tell the truth to your liberal viewers. What a shame. Just repeat more lies. I was watching all the right wing. I don't care what the left has to say on this because I have my own view. So I'm reading all the right wing blather, you know, the Americans for Limited, you know, Government and Red Watch and this, that, and the other thing watch, and all these right wing groups sending out their fundraising emails. And it's, you know, oh my God, we got them. You know, oh, the Obama administration did this. The intelligence agencies did this. It was an alphabet soup of, you know, attacks on our dear leader. It was, you know, 316 pages of crimes by Obama. Yeah, it was heavy on the Obama. You know, there was, you know, Trump was wrongfully targeted. You know, the alphabet agencies came for him. You had Josh Hawley, you know, saying, hey, we need to defund the FBI. Break them up. There was all this stuff on the right. All kinds of craziness. And when you look at the actual report, the report makes a lot of allegations. It's an interesting, you know, read. It doesn't have any. And these are the right-wing groups. The right-wing groups, you know, saying, you know, we regret to inform you that, you know, they didn't come up with any reasonable remedies to the abuses. So this report does all this stuff. Says it's like the Mueller report, actually. You know, there was, Trump did all this stuff. We have verifiable facts, but we don't have anything that concrete for you to do. Here's where I'm at. You want my opinion? My opinion is no one brought this stuff before a court of law. Durham got nothing. Durham spent a couple of years investigating, got nothing. Because there's nothing there. This is going to be a lot of much ado about nothing. There's going to be a lot of, you know, crying and complaining. Oh my gosh. Look at all these things. But no one going before, and this is where my litmus test for everything is, on any side of the equation, no one is going before the robed people, putting their hand on that book that they say they love so much and swearing to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help them God. This is the important part. Under the penalty of perjury. They haven't done that. So until they do this, this is a nothing burger to me. There's nothing to see. It's nicely written. It's talk radio on paper. This is stuff that's going to give the right a ton of stuff to go, look what they did. We got all kinds of stuff. We're going to get them. We're going to get them. It's going to get the right all tizzied up. Going to get them all lathered up in the panties. Oh boy, we're going to get them. Finally going to get them. Got the smoking gun. And they're never going to take it into a court of law. So what is this about? This is about raking money in from you. This is about taking their viewers and using them as little cash machines, because they know you're going to be outraged by this. Oh my gosh, it's outrage central. How can you not be outraged? While you're looking at the Miami Herald, who today, I saw an article, it was over the weekend, that the FBI raided a Russian-owned condominium in Florida. Trump Tower number 3. Yeah, I know, nothing. Nothing to see. Move along. Nothing to see. But be outraged by a report that nobody read. It's 300 and some pages. It's by a guy who failed to bring any substantive charges.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media app.
ABC News.